15. And we're talking about chapter 21, and let's begin with a word of prayer, shall we? Lord, again, thank you for this day, and thank you for the breath of life that we have still in us. We ask that you would be with us in this class as we examine photosynthesis and the amazing miracle that it is, and that we may once again appreciate, and even more deeply if possible, the wonderful creation that you are responsible for. In Jesus' name, amen. I've been in conversation with a young lady, with a woman I met in academy, former classmate, on Facebook. She's teaching. She basically is no longer an Adventist. She, however, teaches science, and yet still wants to be a part of the a creationist viewpoint. And so we've been having some back and forth about how she can deal with some of the issues of creation versus evolution. And she has some trouble with the time frame of the length of what's in the, based on biblical things versus evidence in terms of carbon dating and all this other kind of stuff would have. So it's been an interesting dialogue on that. Life is much more complex than we even still can imagine. And one of the most impressive complexities, most impressive processes occur in photosynthesis because of the extraordinarily complicated nature of extracting enough energy out of a photon to oxidize oxygen. You get my drift? We're oxidizing oxygen. We're moving electrons from oxygen, from water, essentially. And that alone is an impressive chemistry. And to have it done on such a massive scale worldwide, it boggles the mind. But at any rate, so let's go ahead and quickly run through some of the fundamentals of this. Did you ever get the handout check? It's printed out in chat. I printed it out for you. It's in the printer in the department. Go get it. I'm sorry. All right. So, 1.5 times 10 to the 22nd kilojoules falls on the Earth each day, which is a huge amount of energy. And they figure that about 1% of that falls on there is absorbed by photosynthetic organisms into chemical energy. Tremendous amount of energy in that. And you can see that. I mean, when you look at the energy in a gallon of gasoline or a gallon of jet fuel, it's incredibly impressive. And all that apparently had to come from photosynthesis. Tremendous amount of power. There it is, 6 carbon dioxide, 6 waters, mixed glucose, and 6 oxygens that gets released. A bunch of tons of carbon dioxide fixed globally. Formation of sugar from carbon dioxide requires energy, and sunlight is a sun energy source. It's not surprising why the Egyptians worshipped the sun. The photosynthesis occurs in the thylakoid membranes of chloroplasts. The structures involved in paired folds called laminae that stack to form grana. The soluble portion of the chloroplast is called stroma. That relates to the same interior of the mitochondria called the matrix. The matrix is the interior. The interior of the thylakoid vesicles themselves is called a thylakoid space or the thylakoid lumen. The chloroplasts possess DNA, RNA, and ribosomes. So, and so do mitochondria. Mitochondria also contain DNA, RNA, and ribosomes. And evolutionary biologists believe that both the chloroplast and the mitochondria were at one time bacteria or bacteria-like things that were encapsulated by other larger things, and there was a synergy, and it really doesn't explain a lot of things, but that's the model they're using. You need to recall the schematic diagram of idealized chloroplast, be able to identify the labels here. Either I'm going to give you the labels and you draw the lines, or I'll draw the you have the lines. I'll blank out the labels and you put the labels in next to the line. There could be an idea in which I simply scramble all this and figure out. You tell me what each part is. Similar to the mitochondria, the outer membrane, inner membrane, but in additional, there's the thylakoid membrane, which is in here, and that can stack to form these lamina, which is similar in some respects appearances to Golgi apparatus. The stroma that then connects these stacks, and there's an inside part of that membrane. So there actually is this chloroplast contains three layers of membrane, an outer, an inner, and the thylakoid. And so it is an impressively complex organ, subcellular organelle in the thing. And all the photosynthesis occurs right there in the membrane, these folded membranes in the interior. All right, now photosynthesis consists of both light and dark reactions. Now, for those of you who had more than just, well, this is basically a quick review of foundations of biology. But we're going to look in depth at the chemistry in just a little bit. Light reactions are those reactions that require the presence of photons. Dark reactions are chemical reactions that do not require the presence of photons. Now, the dark reactions can occur. They can occur in the presence of photons, and they do. The dark reactions are continually operating, but they are not dependent on the presence of photons, whereas the light reactions are. The light reactions capture the energy and convert it to chemical energy, primarily by making ATP and ADP, and then the ADPH, NADPH, and they result with the elimination of oxygen. Again, NADPH is primarily known as the reductive power for biosynthesis. When you see NADPH, you're primarily talking about biosynthesis. That's a division of labor by chemical. Oddly enough, you can think of organelles and organisms having a division of labor, but also even small molecules like NAD, a simple addition of a phosphate, completely changes its behavior and its function in a cell. The dark reactions that use NADPH and ATP, of course, then do the actual fixing of the sugar. But you do not, all you have to have is NADPH and ADP present. You can either add it by the outside or for reserves from previous photochemical processes. But the dark reactions simply require these two chemicals and carbon dioxide to make them occur. They do not require the presence of light, although they occur in the presence of light. Here's a simple model of what happens. You got the chloroplast, you got light, and as soon as light begins to hit the chloroplast, oxygen begins to be evolved, and then they can turn off the light and move it into the dark, and if carbon dioxide is available, it then begins to fix, become captured as carbon dioxide. And the two, the light requiring and the dark requiring, can be independent. You cannot evolve oxygen in the dark. You cannot evolve or release oxygen in the dark. That requires light. But you can capture carbon dioxide in the dark because that requires two chemicals that don't require the presence of light, just that they are previously made. Water is the electron donor for photosynthetic NADPH. Okay, these equations are probably not correct according to current text. This is an old overhead. There are some photosynthetic bacteria that use hydrogen sulfide or isopropanol or other oxidizable substrates to extract the electrons out of. The oxygen we depend on depends on, in turn, large amounts of photosynthesis on the Earth. And it must be a tremendous amount of photosynthesis, because when you look at the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere relative to carbon dioxide, photosynthesis has occurred in a tremendous aspect. Let's review the what are the four primary gases in the atmosphere. What's the primary and largest what's the largest component of gas in the atmosphere? Nitrogen. What's the next largest component? Oxygen. What's the next largest component? Water vapor. What's the next largest component? Carbon dioxide. This is about 78%. This is, I've heard 18, I've heard 20%. This is variable, one from 0% to 4%. The 0% would be like in a desert, 4% would be like Miami in the summer. And carbon dioxide is much, much less than 1%. At one time or another, from the evolutionary model, one time or another, there's probably a lot more carbon dioxide than oxygen, but all the photosynthesis has reduced the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere and increased the oxygen in the atmosphere significantly, and that has changed and created the kind of organisms that now survive and prosper in oxygen. But oxygen itself, oddly enough, is fairly toxic to most proteins. We live kind of in an awful balance. As we breathe in oxygen and circulate it in our bloodstream, the very presence of oxygen and the high energy compounds we have produce peroxides. These peroxides are high energy oxygen radicals that can damage membranes and so on. That's why there is a big push to eat antioxidants, try to reduce the damage of oxygen, although there is no known disease that can be attributed directly to peroxides or oxygen. Now, how does the capture chlorophyll? It's based, of course, on this the chlorophyll thing, which is built up from porphyrins, magnesium in place of iron. Now, where do you find iron? Iron and porphyrin makes what? Hemoglobin. That's absolutely correct. And then long chain five-hole groups confer membrane solubility. Aromaticity makes chlorophyll an efficient absorber of light. In other words, there's a large resonance structure here. You can see all the double bonds that are in resonance form here, and that lowers the absorption spectrum of chlorophyll well into the visible region. You can see the extraordinary similarity between that and hemoglobin. Of course, hemoglobin does not have this huge tail here that helps it maintain its position in the membranes. Here's the absorption spectrum of you have this in black and white, I'm pretty sure. Here's the absorption spectrum of chlorophyll. Here you can see there's an A and B chlorophyll, and that A and B chlorophyll has to do with the side chains that you see here on the previous slide. The spectrum, of course, strong absorber in blue and purple, strong absorber in yellow and red. Not so much here in this what region right here? Green. So it has a tendency to reflect green. Therefore, our leaves are green. If we go to another planet, there are trees in which the leaves actually absorb the chlorophyll. They have a particular, peculiar kind of chromophores, not chlorophyll. They have contained chlorophyll, but they have other what they call chromophores that absorb in the green region but reflect in the deep red and purple, and they end up having these really dark-colored leaves, unusual colored leaves. So the green is not absorbed, but the blue and the red is, and that has a significant role to play here. The primary chlorophyll absorption, however, for energy is down in the 600 and 700 region. Here's some other compounds that absorb light energy in the visible region. You can see they're highly conjugated. In terms of their double bonds, that's why the absorption spectrum is at a low level. You do not need to memorize these structures, just understand that beta-carotene and phycocyanobilin, bilin is a chromophore, very common one. Beta-carotene you find in carrots. It's one of the primary chromophores. It does not absorb. Matter of fact, it reflects light in what frequency or what color? What color is a carrot? Orange. So it absorbs everything but orange. So it's an interesting situation there. And it's interesting that carrot has that same color underground, because if you've seen carrots, they grow underground. The green part's above. Why they even have that color underneath, I have no idea. All right. You can buy... I was watching the Food Network, and you can buy carrots that are white, pigmentless. Mini chlorophylls. A photosynthetic unit is mini chlorophylls, but only a single reaction center. The reaction center is where the oxidation of oxygen occurs. But there is a broad net that absorbs light energy over a larger area per reaction center. The unit consists of several hundred light-captioning chlorophylls plus a pair of reaction chlorophylls in the reaction center, a pair of special chlorophylls in the reaction center. Light is captured by the antenna chlorophylls and routed from one to the other until it reaches the reaction center. Light energy is captured, and the energy is routed from one unit until another until it reaches the reaction center. So, here you have, literally, it is a hexagon of light-absorbing units. But randomly placed throughout this area is a single reaction center and has a special chemistry involved with it. Each of these, all of them, including the reaction center, contain chlorophyll. The reaction center itself contains a special pair of chlorophyll. But light can be absorbed here, and an electron raised in energy from the ground state to an excited state. And then as the energy searches for the reaction center, that energy is transferred from chlorophyll to chlorophyll in a highly efficient manner, such that the energy of the initial chlorophyll that received the photon energy, it drops those electrons from excited state to ground state, and that energy is transferred losslessly to the next chlorophyll. And the next chlorophyll has its electrons promoted from ground state to excited state, and that simply occurs on a rapid basis throughout the chlorophyllic antenna until it reaches the reaction center. So multiple photons can be hitting this at a time, and all of them eventually move to, in a random walk kind of thing, to find the reaction center. Now, in the reaction center, you find that there are two light systems, two coordinated sets of complex proteins that act in concert. PS1 and PS2, photosystem 1 and photosystem 2. Photosystem 1 was the first one discovered, and had a strongest absorption in the 700 nanometer range. PS2 was discovered later and was discovered to absorb its strongest radiation at 680 nanometers. Now, which of these two energies, which of these two light frequencies or wavelengths has the highest energy? Is it the 700 that has the highest energy or the 680? 680 has the higher energy. That's exactly correct. It's ever so slightly higher, but it does make a difference. All right. Now, so all chlorophyll is a part of either. Now, the LHC needs to be explained. That's abbreviation for light harvesting complex. Light harvesting complex. That's this thing right here. The light harvesting pigment is a part of the light harvesting complex. Is everything okay? Did you get what you needed? All right, I just want to make sure. Yes. Yeah, they could hit here or here or here.
So they hit random.
Mm-hmm. The photonic energy does. Yeah.
So, but they all end up at the...
Oddly enough, they eventually randomly end up here. Like, as far as I can tell, it's a random process. No, you don't. We don't lose them. They don't disappear. Now, it's not 100% efficient. There are, and I didn't include this, but there are pathways. Ground state. Once that photon is elevated to an excited state, it actually has about three to four different possible fates as that electron returns to ground state. It has three to four different fates. One of the fates is you produce heat as it falls back to ground state. So if you could have the leaf, in one area and have light, have it in controlled temperature, and have a thermocouple right on the leaf, very sensitively, as you irradiate it with energy, light energy, you could sense a raise in temperature of the heat that came from this heat process. The next one is, oddly enough, fluorescence. What that means, it absorbs in one frequency and gives off light in another frequency. So, emits light at frequency other than absorbed. So the fluorescence. So if you could irradiate a leaf with one color of light and observe it in a different color of light, you would see it glow in that different color of light. It's an interesting situation. And then of course that's a fate two. There's a third fate, of course, where it resonates with to another chlorophyll. That's what's happening here, is that resonance transfer. And I don't remember what the fourth one is right off the top of my head, but there is another one. So there's at least three fates for that photonic energy that lands on that chlorophyll. Do you remember what the fourth one would be? Ring a bell? Okay. All right. So the fact is that they can irradiate at 700 and or irradiate at 680, and they do have evolution of oxygen. However, if they irradiate both simultaneously, then they get more oxygen than if they get the sum of the amounts when each is used alone. So there's a synergy between 780 and 700 and 680. In each case, what happens here is, it appears the model that you have right here is that the PS2, which actually contains the higher energy light, is the light that's responsible for extracting electrons out of water, and so it's a very powerful accumulating system that eventually pulls the electrons out of the oxygen, out of the water, and it moves from a plus 8 a volt to approximately zero voltage. And then the next system then takes those high energy electrons and even makes them a higher energy or more reduced with additional energy, and that reductive power is used to bind the electrons onto NADPH. So there's a tremendous amount of power transfer that's going on here as the chlorophyll absorbs the photon energy. and it's multiple photons is required for this to occur. Multiple photons. Now, a single photon will not do this. And we'll see that in just a little bit. Here is the Z scheme for photosynthesis. And the most interesting, fascinating, and completely outrageous process in this whole system occurs right here at this manganese complex. Can you read that in your handout? Can you read where it says manganese? I also want you to point to this and label this as the oxygen evolving complex. The oxygen evolving complex. You will also be prepared to see that as an OEC abbreviation. OEC, oxygen evolving complex. The details of which are we will look at later, next couple slides. But the magnesium complex, manganese complex, is where photonic energy is accumulated and eventually gets so strong that it's able to extract electrons from water, release elemental oxygen, and use those electrons to eventually make NADPH. So you can see here, this is a diagram. They call it a Z-scheme diagram because it shows from the oxidation state to the reductive state what's actually happening. So a photon lands here on this P680 and is promoted, literally promoted, and then transferred away from the photosystem tube. So the electron that was there is actually now moved on to something else. There's a hole right here. Well, a hole, of course, is not welcome in nature. A vacuum, nature abhors a vacuum, as they say. So electrons are then withdrawn from the manganese complex in sequential form to fill in that hole. Well, if another photon hits this, it gets promoted. There's still a hole there. More electrons are dumped into here. Eventually, the manganese complex has lost so many electrons and becomes so oxidized that it can then extract the electrons from water to fill its holes, which then are used to fill its hole, this hole, which is then to allow, then you have these electrons cascading through the rest of the Z scheme. Okay, so low reductive potential, high productive potential. Alright, so note that the electron acceptors are on the stromal side of the thylakoid membrane, whereas the donors are situated on the luminal side of the membrane, on the interior side of the membrane. So water is actually inside. If you're taking water out of that interior of the lumen. Let me go ahead here. So electrons then eventually that are promoted to high energy eventually move on to a series of metallic proteins, metalloproteins, primarily known as quinones, which are copper materials. And then there's some iron sulfides here, cytochromes as well. And what happens here is that this is linked to a membrane, and as these electrons pass from photosystem 2 to the relatively low energy photosystem 1, they pass through a hydrogen pump. And so, as it says here, I think it says protons taken up from stroma and released in the lumen. So you've got a situation here where so protons are pumped from the stroma and then pumped into this luminal region as photons pass from PS2 to PS1. Let me repeat that. Protons are pumped from the stromal into the luminal region as electrons move from PS2 to PS1. As the proton concentration increases in that lumen, they are allowed then to pass back through the luminal membrane via an ATP synthase. And you make ATP that way. So, protons released into lumen, then you can say here, protons are allowed to pass back into the stroma, passing through the ATP synthase, to make ATP. or you can say protons return to the stroma via, protons return to the stroma via, VIA, via ATP synthase, making ATP. So this process from here is one way that ATP is made in the plant. These electrons eventually land on the 700, P700 system. A photon hits it. That again is promoted, leaving a hole for allowing for these electrons to come in. Where do these electrons come from that are being promoted right here? Where do they come from ultimately? What's the ultimate source of these electrons? Manganese. Where does manganese get its electrons from? Water. So essentially, all the electrons that land here have come sometime from water. They get promoted by a photon, a series of photons. They go through a series of cytochromes and other metallo enzymes and proteins, and eventually end up on a protein that has an FAD interior and functional group, and then the electrons are dumped onto NADPH and NADP to make the reduced NADPH form. So circle this and say reductive power for biosynthesis. Reductive power for biosynthesis, NADPH. What is the primary pathway in the cell, in the eukaryotic cell, like us, that use these chemicals, use reduced carbon dioxide, reduce glucoses and stuff? What is the pathway that we use to make NADPH? Pentose phosphate pathway. That's exactly correct. The pentose phosphate pathway. So the pentose phosphate pathway is where we produce NADPH. And in the plant, it's where NADPH is used, a variation of it, is used to capture carbon dioxide. All right. Oxygen evolution by PS2 requires accumulation of four oxidizing equivalents. PS2, that's a P60, cycles through five oxidation states. This is of the manganese ion. The oxidation states are the manganese ion. And one electron is removed in each of the four steps. And eventually that makes the manganese so highly oxidized that in the fifth step, it can remove the two electrons from oxygen, or four electrons from oxygen, produce four electrons from water to produce oxygen and four hydrogen ions. All right? Let's take a look what this means. How did they discover that it had to have four or five cycles? And the flash number here doesn't coordinate all that well, but you get the idea. So what they've done is this. Oxygen involved, I'm going to read this caption, because it's really important. This is a figure 2113 in the handout. Oxygen evolution requires accumulation of four oxidizing equivalents in PS2. Dark adapted chloroplasts, that means they've been in the dark for 24 hours, but otherwise fully, all their material needs are fully met. So dark adapted chloroplasts show little oxygen evolution after two brief light flashes. So they get a very powerful strobe, and they have an oxygen sensor and a leaf that's ready and able to produce oxygen. Bam, bam, no oxygen. But bam, on the third and every fourth thereafter, oxygen, they can see it being evolved from the chlorophyll or from the chloroplasts. The oscillation in O2 evolution is dampened by repeated flashes and converges to an average value after 20 or so flashes. In other words, it's not perfect. There's situations where some will evolve and others will not, and as you add more flashes, the it becomes out of sync, and there's no good way of determining what's going on. The oscillation of evolutions per light flash is due to the cycling of PS2 reaction center through five different oxidation states. Now, this says PS2 reaction center. You could also write in there EOC. The oxygen evolving complex is actually what's going through that oxidation state. It's the manganese that's making the oxidation state. That is altering its oxidation state. When the stage 4 is reached, O2 is released. Oh, I have got to sneeze. No, pardon me. All right. I'm going to blow out a lung doing that one of these days. They say never try to hold a sneeze. But I just can't. Never mind. You don't care. I'm not putting you too much to sleep today, am I? Well, I do, but it hurts. It actually, I can feel my lungs stretch a little bit. Anyway, when the stage 4 is reached, oxygen is evolved. One electron is moved photochemically at each light flash, moving the reaction center successfully through S1, S2, S3, S4. S4 decays spontaneously, S0. By oxidizing two waters to oxygen, the peak O2 evolution flash at 3 is in part due to the fact the isolated chloroplast suspension is already at stage 1. So you find it's typically is in dark adapted. It's here at stage 1. Photon. Then it releases, and photon moves it back to stage 1 again. But there are photon. That's what happens after the first release of oxygen. You count up 4 more flashes before another oxygen is released. So the manganese is going through these various oxidation states. I mean, you have to look at this. Manganese is having its oxidation state increased plus 1 4 different times. Plus 1, plus 2, plus 3, plus 4. Then simultaneously in a single step, it extracts 4 electrons from water to make oxygen and reduces itself back to 0 oxidation state. And it goes through it again. And each time, so it releases electrons 1 at a time, but it can react with water to collect all 4 at a time. I mean, how's that possible? Yes? No, where are they?
Well, you said that they go to like a higher level each time, right?
Correct, and then they're immediately removed. In other words, that this is the unique thing about the chlorophyll. Remember I described that all the chlorophyll in the antenna were the same except the 2 chlorophyll that are in the reaction center. And it's a mystery wrapped in enigma, and they've spent man years of science, of plant biochemistry, trying to figure out exactly what it is about those special pair. But that electron that was removed has actually been promoted here and then removed from PS2. It can't fall back. In other words, that this electron right here, the photon, it says it's hitting the oxygen-evolving complex. This is just it's a diagram that's a little misleading. What's actually happening is the photon is hitting some chlorophyll, and that energy eventually gets to the reaction center where those special pair chlorophylls have their electrons immediately promoted and then removed, transferred to an electron transport system, and leaves an electronic hole here that's filled with electrons from the magnesium. So this manganese, pardon me, this electron here is moving immediately to fill the ground state of a PS2 chlorophyll. So it can't fall back. When you become a biochemist, you realize that can't is probably not word can't, never, always. Because I absolutely guarantee you that for every system that looks, oh, this is the only way that's done, someplace, somewhere, there's some organism doing it differently. Okay? Even if it's a minor change. So I will never say this electron cannot fall back. But it is transferred with such a high efficiency that it's a rare event that it would fall back. Yeah. Do you have one that I don't have? Oh, yeah, I probably dropped that. Okay, I don't know. Let's see here. Where is this? There is a slide at... This is called... What does... Did you have the previous slide? Okay, thank you for pointing that out. I might have... Ah, yes. I probably was too aggressive in condensing this. So it says, what does each photosystem do? PS2 oxidizes water. PS2 oxidizes water. This is, do you have this? Can I show it to everybody to see this one? Yeah. Yeah, I missed that. I mean, I don't have it here. What does each photosystem do? Oxidizes water and reduces NADP. That, you got it right. Excellent. Reduces NADP. All right. What's a quantum yield? Quantum yield. Quantum leap. Ever hear of that? Oh, that's an old television program. Ever hear of it? Quantum leap? Okay. All right. It's amount of O2 evolved per photon. Photon. 4 photons per reaction center. 8 total. Drive the evolution of 1 oxygen. 2 reduction of NADPH. Reduction of 2 NADPH. And the phosphorylation of 2. And 2/3 ATP. So, 4 photons per reaction center. 4 for PS2 to produce the electrons, to produce that molecule of oxygen. 4 at PS1 to promote it up to get make it enough, reduced high enough to make NADPH. So, 8 photons drive the evolution of 1 oxygen. Production of 2 NADPHs and the phosphorylation. Remember, phosphorylation, which occurs right here, the pumping, phosphorylation of, and I don't know where they get this, 2 2/3 ATP. I don't know where they get 2/3 from, but that's just the way it is. Good luck with that. All right. How does light drive the synthesis of ATP? This is called photophosphorylation. Electron transfer through the proteins of the Z scheme drive the generation of photon gradient across the thylakoid membrane. I think we discussed that already. Protons pumped in the lumen, flow back out, driving the synthesis of ATP. Make sense? The CF1, CF0 ATP synthase is similar to the mitochondrial ATP synthase. I wish we had time to go through that. The protein chemistry, the structural sophistication of that particular ATP synthase is a marvel of creativity. And not by accident. Cyclic phosphorylation, ATP without NADPH. Now, can you make ATP without NADPH? Yes. Photoexcited electrons removed from PO2 returned via to P700, the pathway indicated by dashed line. Cyclic phosphorylation depends only on PS1, not PS2. So let me go back here. You see this dashed line, ladies and gentlemen. As a photon hits this electron and promotes it, that electron actually has 2 choices. The electrons can move on then to produce NADPH, or it can go through a cyclic process back through the electron transport system of the membrane, pumping protons. And if you're pumping protons, you're making ATP. So this dotted line represents the cyclic electron pathway of PS1. The cyclic electronic pathway or electron pathway, cyclic electron pathway. What else did I say? For the production of ATP, to pump protons, photosystem 1. There's no cyclic structure in PS2. It's only PS1. Righty then. This is going to be very handy to know. The concepts involved in the oxygen evolution. Every oxygen that you're breathing right now at one time was, in fact, trapped as carbon dioxide and has been recycled through some plant. So you can make ATP without any DPH. That's what this does. This cyclic form makes ATP without making any DPH. The cyclic form makes ATP without making any DPH. All right. Okay, let's go ahead. How is carbon dioxide used to make organic molecules? Here's the essence of the second part of it. The production of oxygen is dependent on light. The production of carbohydrate is not dependent on light. So the production of oxygen is part of the light reactions. The production of carbohydrate, production of fixed carbon dioxide, production of glucose, I'm saying the same thing, that is not dependent on light and is a part of the dark reactions. All right, Calvin at Berkeley, 1945, that the chlorella, which is an algae, can take up carbon-14 and produce labeled 3-phosphoglycerate. So pathway understanding exploded after World War II when all these radioisotopes that were discovered during weapons research in making the atomic bomb could be used in discerning the pathway of these organic molecules. What was happening was actually that carbon dioxide was combined with a 5-carbon sugar to form a 6-carbon intermediate. Then this breaks down to form 3-P glycerates, which can be reformed to anything you want. Now, let me just remind you again, when you look at gluconeogenesis, just help me out here. When you look at gluconeogenesis, what was the compound that was supposedly the beginning of gluconeogenesis? It was at the bottom of that. It was bound with carbon dioxide and oxaloacetate. What carbon structure was that? Pyruvate. Pyruvate is at the bottom of gluconeogenesis. How many carbons does pyruvate have? 3. So from 3 carbons, nature can make glucose. 2 carbons, we cannot as mammals make fat. 2 carbons can be made into glucose using the glyoxylate cycle. At any rate, so the fact that it gets broken down to 3 glycerates, to 3 carbon units, these glycerates, is irrelevant in terms of production of carbohydrate because you can easily make carbohydrate from 3 carbon units. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on Friday. There'll be a little bit of a quiz on Friday. I think probably what we'll do is we'll just have a practice quiz. You need to review, but probably won't be points. The next time we have...